Orconaut Podcast. I'm your host, Sean Wright, and you're listening to episode 4. In this podcast, I'm chatting with author Rabia Gale. Originally born in Karachi, Pakistan, she now lives in the States with her husband and children. Welcome to the podcast, Rabia.
Thanks for having me, Sean.
Okay, first question. You came to my attention last year with your collection Shattered, Broken Fairy Tales, and I was impressed by both your writing and the fresh take on the tales. And I wanted to ask, what was it that compelled you to rework the three well-known tales?
Well, I've always been interested in fairy tales. I think it's true for most writers. I was interested in some of the what-ifs moments for those fairy tales. Like, one of the things for the Cinderella tale, you know, it has always seemed to me that marrying a woman based on her shoe size was, well, not really the right way to go about things. And so the premise just popped into my head, well, what if he found the wrong woman with the same shoe size, and the story just went from there. So these are all well-known stories, and I feel like they're a really good vehicle for exploring some deeper issues of love and beauty and expectations that we place on ourselves and on each other. And so I just twisted them. They're a little darker than a lot of the other stuff that I write, but they were very compelling premises.
It's something that attracted me in a sense, is because the Australian authors that I sort of closely follow tend to write in that vein. Thinking of Margot Lanigan, for example, writes dark takes on fairy tales, and also Lisa Hannett and Angela Slatter. I almost felt as if I didn't know your background living in the States, I could have mistaken you for one of the current crop of Australian dark fantasy writers. I want to talk a little bit about your work as a whole. In addition to short online publication, you've also released a cyberpunk version of Rapunzel in Wired.
Right.
You've done a paranormal urban fantasy or a collection in Unseen.
Mm-hmm.
Then most recently, you've released two novellas, Rainbird and Morning Cloak, the first quirky science fantasy, and it reminded me a bit of, at least in a visual sense, because I haven't read the book, but of the movie, The City of Ember. I don't know if you've seen that.
No, I haven't.
No, it's, something about, I don't know, something about it struck me. It's not steampunk to me, but it's somewhere close to that was what I was feeling when I read that.
Mm-hmm.
And then, in Morning Cloak, you've gone, from what I can tell, because I've only just bought it, and it's in that list of to be reads when I have time, apart from my other reviews. You seem to be supremely comfortable in the subgenres you're writing in. And I just wanted to ask, after that very long intro, what has drawn you to write in such diverse worlds and genres?
Okay, actually, it's kind of funny. I don't really think of myself as a writer who writes across multiple genres. I tend to stick fairly close to fantasy, which is the one that I'm most comfortable with. I guess when you put it that way, it does seem that I explore different facets of fantasy. I have, like I said, some darker work in my broken fairy tales, and then I have more adventurous fantasy. And, I just follow where my interests lead. And right now my interests are leading me to more science fantasy. I am just stepping away from the medieval-based fantasy, the pseudo-medieval settings that characterized, a lot of my early work, and also just a lot of the big books in the fantasy genre. And I feel that the science fantasy works so much better for modern audiences, especially, I grew up in a very urban environment. the rural aspect of most adventure fantasy is really very removed from me. So it's only seemed natural to bring in more technology into fantasy because it more accurately reflects my technology-saturated life right now. So I feel more comfortable with the science fantasy that I'm writing now.
When I look at it, I suppose I see one of the good things about your work is that it does seem fresh. It doesn't seem to me like you're writing to any sort of preset idea of what you need to do to be a certain type of writer. So it comes across to me as very very fresh and original work, with, you know, with tinges of I suppose what's current to hook the reader in. A good deal of your recent work, bar the co-authored story Sand and Seawater with Joanne Anderton, mm-hmm. which is coming out, I think, very shortly in the One Small Step anthology, most of your work is self-published, and I wanted to discuss how you came to make that decision.
Okay. Self-publishing came to me at a good time of my life. I had been writing for many years. And when I first started writing, I followed all the rules. I'm a rule follower. And so I did all the things you were supposed to do. I wrote a lot. I wrote short stories. I joined a online writing workshop. And, you know, I followed the blogs that I was supposed to follow, and I got my work critiqued, and I submitted to magazines and to agents when I had novels to submit. And all of that was valuable and good. I don't regret doing that for a moment. But I had gotten to the point where I was getting a lot of, you know, close enough, your writing is good, send us something else. And I was just really tired, I think, of the whole query go around. And it was a good time in my life for a change. My family had just moved. We had lived in one area for about 10 years. And it just seemed like a good time in my life to make a change in my career. I also had some projects that were that were exciting to me, that I didn't feel that they were projects that I could sell in the traditional market. Most specifically, my novellas, Rainbird and Morning Cloak. There's just not a big market for in traditional publishing for the vast lengths between short story and novels. So, you know, taking all of those into consideration, it was a good opportunity and a good time for me to jump into self-publishing, and really reinvigorated my writing. I was feeling quite a lot of fatigue, and being able to get my work out there, being able to get it read, having slowly building a readership was very reinvigorating to my writing.
With traditional publishing, you usually will wait, a good year before you've finished off the work, before it actually gets out there. And so that's a year where you've got no feedback from the readership. And I was wondering if by self-publishing, I mean, you're still doing all the professional sort of work on getting it polished, but you're able to release it in a shorter time and get it out there and read by people. And I'm wondering if that's had a positive effect on your confidence in your writing.
Right. I don't know if my writing style, the way I write, I am not a fast writer. I have a tendency to start something, and then about three quarters of the way through, I leave it and go work on something else. My mind just needs to sit, and think about things. And then, after a month or so, I'll come back to the project and finish it out. And it just, there's a whole lot of sort of fallow time when I'm working on any story. I let it sit after I'm done. I send it out to beta readers. They get back to me with their remarks. And So by the time I'm done with all of that, you know, editing and, you know, just first writing it and then editing it and then letting it sit and then proofreading it, quite a lot of time goes by. So I'm not sure if traditional publishing would really make me wait a lot longer than my natural writing, revising, publishing style. Though once I get my work out there, the response is definitely, I mean, it can definitely be hard on the nerves because you just don't know how people are going to respond. At least with being traditionally published, you can say, well, somebody thought my work was worth buying. With self-publishing, that's not the case at all. So when I do get a positive response, it definitely builds my confidence up. But it is always, I'm always very anxious when my work first goes out and I'm waiting for those early first reviews to come in.
I think you might have answered some of what I'm going to ask in the next question. If someone asks me about recommending good self-published authors, you're among the three names that I have absolutely no hesitation in mentioning. And I just wanted to ask, what sort of professionalism do you impose on yourself in order to produce your quality writing?
Definitely having my work read by beta readers, and I am hard on myself as well. You know, there was, when I first self-published Shattered and I was thinking about what next to self-publish, one of the titles that came to mind was my very first published story, that because it was my first published story, I loved to bits. But when I looked at it again, you know, because the magazine that published it, you know, no longer exists, so that work was not around anymore. But when I looked at it again, it just did not meet the standard writing that I knew that I was capable of achieving now. And I just didn't feel right about putting that out there with a price tag for somebody to buy when I knew that it's an early work, and I don't think it was putting my best foot forward. So even though I had planned a collection with it in it, I had to, you know, scrap those plans. And so I really do look very carefully at the work that I'm putting out to make sure that I feel that it is good enough to be out there. It's not, I don't really throw spaghetti at the wall and hope that something will stick. I do also have beta readers. Joanne Anderton is one of them. And these readers do a really good job keeping me on track. And they really tell me when something isn't working. I just recently, sent a short story out to my readers, and, you know, it came back with, there's just something missing in this. So even though I had plans for that story, I'm going to just have to let it sit until I can figure out what is wrong with it. Until I can fix it, I'm not going to submit it anywhere or release it in any way until I'm confident that it is the best that I can do at this point in time. And aside from that, you know, I do a lot of line editing. I work, you know, I do plenty of proofreading passes. That's one of the things I don't like about self-publishing, is because I just feel like my eyeballs are about to liquefy, because I do at least two or three of those passes before anything goes out. I have a cover artist whose work I really love, and she's very professional, and I'm very pleased with the covers that she gives me. And then my husband, who's very technical, handles my ebook formatting, and we work hard at making the ebooks look good. So I do hold myself to high standards.
You talked most recently on your blog about a longer work, a novel called Quartz, mm-hmm. and you look like you're going to experiment with serialization for the work. For those not privy to your blog, can you explain why you're thinking in that direction?
This is my year for trying new things. I have really recently come to really enjoy the idea of being my own business, being a business, really, being an artist as well as a businesswoman. And I really like the idea of finding different ways of reaching readers. And I don't like that right now the way to read, you know, my main contact with readers is when I sell through Amazon is primarily, you know, where is the place where I get most of my sales. And I just wanted to kind of cut the middleman out a little bit and have a way of directing readers to my site, you know, my internet home, you know, the place that I control. And serializing is one way of doing that. And I've never tried it before. It's a new thing for me, and it may work, it may flop, I don't know, but it's worth a shot, I think. And yeah, it's exciting times to be a writer. And, you know, I like to be flexible. I haven't given up on, you know, I'm not going to say that I will never accept a traditional publishing contract or a small press publishing contract. Serializing quartz is just one thing to try, one more thing to try.
And it breaks up the line editing as well, I understand.
Yes, yes. 101,000 words. Oh, I don't think my eyeballs could stand the strain.
No, fair enough. And that answered my next question about traditional publishing. So I'll skip on to one that's about women writers. In Australia, women writers of speculative fiction seem to be strongly representing. And this is, as I understand it, different from the situation in the UK and the US, where fantasy and sci-fi or even science fantasy still seems to be male-dominated. And I wondered, has gender been a hurdle for you as a writer of science fantasy? And do you think that self-publishing is a way around that?
I don't think gender has at all been an issue for me. Part of it could be that maybe I have a strange name and nobody can figure out whether I'm a man or a woman from my name, which is, you know, which is a Pakistani name, not well known at all in the U.S. No, so I can't say that gender has been a hurdle for me at all. And looking at just sort of thinking about the authors that I really enjoy, I would say that there's a probably 50-50 mix of men and women in that.
I was going to say, I don't detect a strong American influence in your work. Now, that could just be the subject matter. But what I wanted to concentrate on is what you thought your major influences were. What sort of speculative fiction works form part of your reading canon growing up?
Sure. I grew up in Pakistan, which is a former British colony. So my early reading experiences were very informed by British writers. I grew up reading Enid Blyton, for instance, and, you know, she wrote school stories and adventure stories and fantasy stories. So, you know, my early, my very first exposure to fantasy was probably through her Wishing Chair and Enchanted Wood books. And from there on, I moved on to other British writers like Susan Cooper, who wrote the Darkest Rising series, and Diana Wynne Jones and her Crestomancy novels. I also got into Rosemary Sutcliffe's historical fiction. And when I went to school, we pretty much focused on British literature. We didn't really study much in the way of American literature. So my formative literary experiences have all been British writers. And so whenever I read British writers, there, it always feels like coming home. There's something about a British writer's style that just calls to me and speaks to me. Oh, and I should also mentioned Terry Pratchett. I discovered Pratchett when I was 14, and he has been a huge influence.
I was going to say, listening to the names you rattled off, then it's virtually the same authors that I grew up with, reading Famous Five, and most certainly Rosemary Sutcliffe. I was when I discovered Rosemary Sutcliffe's books, I think I I annoyed the librarians to track down every book that she'd written at
Oh,
that
she's.
point. So
Yeah, she is awesome. I was just rereading parts of The Lantern Bearers just the other night, and just the way she brings an entire lost historical era to life, and the way she's really the master of these poignant, profound, small moments, you know, just one moment, just one significant moment. It's amazing how she's able to just portray one really important moment and just the emotion she's able to evoke from her reader. Yeah, she's awesome.
no arguments from there from me. Well, this is coming up to my last question. I just wanted to throw out there, what's the end goal for Rabia Gal? Longer works, or do you, as others perhaps see, new opportunities arising in the publication of novellas?
Well, my end goal is to do this as a full-time career, to write fiction as my full-time career. Right now, I'm a stay-at-home mom with three kids, and I homeschool. So writing is definitely part-time for me right now. But looking ahead, in another 14 years, my youngest child will be an adult and off to college or, you know, doing his own thing. And so by the time I get You know, we get 14 years down the road, I want to have a good solid foundation built up for making a full-time career out of my writing. And I want to continue writing short stories and novellas. And also, I have a lot of novel ideas that I would also like to get out. I have some mostly science fantasy-ish novel ideas, and I'm sure there'll be many more ideas coming down the pipeline. So I'm thinking very, very long term here. And I also want to be flexible and I want to be open to opportunities that might come my way. This past year of self-publishing has led me to opportunities I otherwise wouldn't have gotten. One, if I hadn't self-published Shattered, I wouldn't have been invited to co-write the short story for the One Small Step anthology. We got around the fact that the anthology is open to Australian writers only by having me co-write with Joe Anderton. And it was a really wonderful experience collaborating with Joe. She and I have been friends for 8, 9 years now, but we've never written anything together. And I feel like we have a good I mean we there are some things that we write very differently, but there's enough overlap that I think that we can write that we the that a co that a partnership between us on certain projects would be very fruitful. So just the opportunities that have come my way, I've just reached out and grabbed them with both hands, and I'm looking forward to more opportunities. Different ones, probably things that I wouldn't expect, you know, down the road. I have no idea, but I'm ready to stretch my creative wings, so to speak.
No, it sounds fascinating. I'm eagerly awaiting whatever you do next because I don't think you've put a foot wrong yet. So it's been an absolute pleasure talking with you, Rabia, and I wanted to thank you for the opportunity.
All right, thank you so much for this.
And that brings us, dear listeners, to the end of the podcast. Thank you for listening. You may leave audio feedback at www.speakpipe.com/bookanaut. Check the show notes for a link, or you may leave written feedback on Facebook, the Podomatic page, or at my blog.